This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When literary legend Reynolds Price died last year, he left behind a significant amount of writing. He also left a valuable art collection, real estate holdings, meaningful personal effects, and correspondences with a veritable who's who of 20th century writers. Eudora Welty, Anne Tyler, William Styron, W.H. Auden, Raymond Carver, Toni Morrison, John Updike, and I've just named a few. So, what's it all worth? How should it be distributed? And how do answers to these questions determine Reynolds Price's legacy? Bill Price is Reynolds' brother and only sibling. He's the executor and literary executor of Reynolds' estate. Memsey Price is Bill's daughter and Reynolds' niece. She's been working with her father on the literary part of Reynolds' estate. And Bill and Memsey Price join me in the studio today. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So, Bill, let's start with the manuscripts. Didn't Reynolds make arrangements during his lifetime to transfer most of those to Duke?
Yes. He had an ongoing arrangement with Duke since the 1970s about transferring both his correspondence and manuscripts to Duke's manuscript department. And that's where his collection is, and it's enormous. I, in fact, have the only literary manuscript of Reynolds' work that didn't go to Duke, the manuscript of his story, The Names and Faces of Heroes, which he gave me when he finished the story on my 22nd birthday.
Wow. So, and you're not giving it up?
Not yet.
I don't blame you. How else does the literary estate break down? What else is there?
Well, Reynolds left a fair amount of unpublished material, the principal piece of which was the manuscript of an unfinished memoir, a continuation of his previous memoir, Ardent Spirits. This one was intended to cover the years 1961 through 67. He managed to get mostly through 1965.
So you've got that, and then you're faced with this challenge. All of a sudden, you know, somebody comes up and asks, well, how do we place a value on this? Is that what happened?
Yeah, and that was a very complicated process. There's something called intellectual property appraisal, and in order to locate an individual and a firm who could do that, it took some time and some doing, but we finally succeeded with a firm out of Atlanta.
Of course, this is pretty common, although it's hard to imagine trying to put even a dollar value on a legacy that is so much more deeply important to all of us for just the literary power and the influence that it's had. But there it is. I mean, there's this challenge. And, Memsey, that's when you come into it. All of a sudden, there's this lot of stuff here that Bill is responsible for, and he gives you a call. Huh?
Right. And I was happy to get that call, actually. I had spent the early part of my career in the book publishing industry, so I was familiar with a lot of the processes and how this stuff works. So I have termed it as Dad being the thinker and me being the doer. I kind of took over helping bring this last memoir through the process of publication with Scribner. That book is called Midstream, and it was released this past May. And then I worked with intellectual property attorneys and others to sort out a very complex estate, because Reynolds not only left 38 books, he left songs that he had co-written with James Taylor and his theatrical works. And so it was quite a complex.
And letters,
right.
Tell us about those and who he corresponded with.
He corresponded, I mean, the list you read is a good representation. And I think that a lot of those folks are still from the generation that wrote letters versus emails.
Right.
And he had given materials regularly over the years to the Rubenstein Library at Duke, but there was still quite a lot of paper in the house. And my father and mother were the main sorters of that. But I did some of it, and it was so hard not to keep at your task because some of those letters were so beautiful from people like Polly Holiday, who is a trained actress from Alabama, best known probably as being Flo on the TV series Alice.
Mm-hmm.
But she wrote these great newsy letters and, you know, the Welty letters and just everyone that you can sort of imagine.
I'm picturing you kind of sitting on the floor all together with these papers all around you saying, oh, Dad, look at this one. Wait, let me read you this.
Yeah, well, and a tremendous help to both of us was my wife, Pia, who really set herself the task of finding certain gems, and she did. One of the most surprising things that Reynolds left behind that he had not transferred to Duke over the years was a series of personal journals that he kept in the 70s and 80s largely. And he had hung on to them not only because they contained certain personal information that he didn't want shared yet, and he closed his papers for 20 years, and I'm pretty much honoring that, although I can grant access. Those journals have gone over to Duke, and they so inform so much of the work he wrote in the 70s and 80s that they're going to be a real boon to Reynolds Price scholarship in years to come.
What about some of the letters that you have seen and that you can talk about? What were some of the most poignant for you, Bill?
The most poignant of his correspondence, I think, comes from people who were survivors, primarily of cancer. And they would encounter his book, A Whole New Life, through the course of time, not just when it came out in the 1990s, but for years afterwards. I mean, it's still in print, yeah. And people get to it at various points long after Reynolds initially published it. And he still had an ongoing correspondence with people who had survived cancer and who talked about how much his book had helped them, and also revelations about their own religious experiences, if you will, that was not unlike Reynolds's vision that he described in Whole New Life.
And these would not be literary lions. These are just readers.
Yeah. Reynolds had a voluminous correspondence with a host of friends and former schoolmates and all that sort of thing over the years. I mean, he had an ongoing correspondence with kids who were in school with him in Warrenton, North Carolina, for goodness sake, in the 1940s. And most of them were people whom he had based his characters in A Long and Happy Life on.
And he did have a different way of seeing when it came to religion, and a deep one. So I'm sure that a lot of people connected on those lines as well.
Yeah. Memsie might want to speak for a minute to the 50th anniversary of A Long and Happy Life that was informed by these kids that Reynolds grew up with in Warrenton.
Yeah.
Yeah, along with the release of Midstream, which is his last book, Scribner re-released his first book, which was a novel called A Long and Happy Life that many people know and love. It's the 50th anniversary of the publication of that book. It was originally published in 1962, and it was a very big deal when it was kind of unexpectedly when it was published.
Yeah, and it's never gone out of print. And one of the things that's nice about the 50th anniversary edition is that Alan Garganis has written a wonderful afterword that accompanies it, and it's a whole splendid achievement.
But was there a connection then with some of the kids you went to school with?
I think in rereading that book, you see all of those kids he went to school with, and at the time he published that book, I think those characters were a bit out of the mold. No one was really writing in that sort of Southern vernacular. That quite about North Carolina and quite that way he was. And it's really a beautiful book, and I think for readers who are fans of that book and who have been fans of his, they may want to, you know, they could look at Midstream and Long Happy Life as sort of bookending his writing life.
And it certainly was that what launched his career was that voice, was giving voice and accent and allowing the Southern accent to sound intelligent and humane in a way that it hadn't.
Yeah.
Does any of the correspondence shed light on that, on the process? Is there anything that you can tell us about that sheds light on the process?
Yeah, he regularly was describing the process to various correspondents of his through those years. He also kept a much more detailed journal about the preparation of A Long and Happy Life than he ever did for any other book. Much of that's been published in a book that Duke University Press did some years ago called Learning a Craft. But Reynolds was writing all the time to folks about what he was doing and sort of hashing his thoughts out there.
And I think that the sum total of the correspondence and the journals and all that, for me at least, revealed how hard he worked at his craft. He really was dedicated and devoted, and he did write every day. And I think that's something that, you know, was really critical to who he was.
He did write every day except Sunday. He said God took Sunday off, and so was he.
And so would he. Did he talk about the difficulty in sort of at once exposing those characters and but also taking care of them in the way that he did?
Yeah, Reynolds was very conscious about protecting people. He was freed in some ways by the death of our mother in the mid-1960s to write about things he wouldn't have written about were she still alive. But he was always very careful to take care of folks. And part of the reason he's closed his correspondence for 20 years is to give it time to rest and generations to shake out.
Those things that he wouldn't have written about, were they about neighbors, friends, family, that sort of thing?
Yeah, for the most part.
He also had an art collection.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that.
Well, Reynolds had a huge and very eclectic art collection. When we got the appraiser in there, who was the lead appraiser for Reynolds's art, I said to her, he's got everything from 2nd century B.C. statuary to a starving artist painting of James Dean that he bought off of eBay for $100 a year ago. And I said, this is going to be quite a task for you. She wound up saying at the end of it all that it was the most interesting appraisal she had ever done.
In large part because it's the fact that Reynolds Price hands touched this piece. And now we have to say it's not the piece that came from eBay. It was in his collection.
Oh, yeah, precisely. And Reynolds loved art as he loved life. And consistently said, if I have a choice of what to buy, it's going to be art. And he did. He bought an awful lot of it, and it brought him great pleasure. And he never bought any of it as an investment. He bought what he liked.
And what will happen to that? Is that going to Duke?
No, it did not go to Duke. In fact, except for specific bequests to 8 or 10 people of items in his collection, it all came to me. And I've disposed of it in various ways, including giving pieces to friends of Reynolds's whom he did not name in his will, and I felt deserved something.
Well, he did have some land, in fact, a house on many acres of land. And at one point, did Reynolds think about the possibility, or you, of turning this into a museum?
Reynolds did consider that possibility. He was a great fan of Ernest Hemingway's house in Key West and your ability to go in there and have an experience. We explored whether or not he might do that. I was running the State Department of Archives and History at the time and had access to lots of information about various kinds of possibilities and options he might have. And when he saw that he was going to have a parking lot that would mean cutting down a lot of the trees on the property, he just decided against it.
And this would be the Reynolds Price Museum we're talking about, right?
Yeah, his house as a museum.
As a museum.
Right, and he abandoned that idea in the 90s.
And, of course, the very fact that his house as a historic site would command a parking lot talks about the star quality of this literary
site. Yeah, exactly.
Something that he was aware of and enjoyed.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, as I said, Reynolds was intrigued with the Ernest Hemingway Museum and other houses of writers that he had visited over time and what he got from that experience and the ambience of the place. But he also recognized that given the location of his house and the need for having a parking lot that was going to accommodate at least 40 parking spaces, he had to make some changes to the landscape he didn't want to make.
But he didn't shy away from publicity. He was somebody who enjoyed his celebrity, didn't he?
Reynolds loved being a celebrity. People would come up to him in restaurants and shake his hand and tell him how much they had enjoyed thus and such, or that they had heard him on the radio or seen him on TV or that sort of thing. He relished it, as he relished stars. I mean, he was drawn to celebrities all of his life. And Midstream, in fact, includes an account of his meeting with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor in Rome when they were making Cleopatra. And it's one of the most rollicking parts of the whole memoir.
Remind us about that moment.
Well, Cleopatra was, a huge financial expense, and it was also the first time that any actor had ever commanded a salary of $1 million, and Elizabeth Taylor got it. And Reynolds always said, as an aside, he doesn't say it in Men's Dream, so I'll give you a scoop here. Reynolds always said, as an aside, that he thought the greatest single attraction of Elizabeth Taylor for Richard Burton was that she commanded this kind of money, and that he, as a Welsh miner's son, simply was blown away by that. And the rest of it, her beauty and everything else, took very much second place to that power she commanded.
Wow.
And the meeting actually kind of happened by chance. This is a story that he recounts in the book, which is that he and Stephen Spender were in Rome, and they got word that Richard Burton was there, and Spender sort of knew Burton, and so they sent, and Burton said, "Oh, come join us for drinks." And then he called up Elizabeth, and then they ended up spending this great afternoon together purely by chance.
Wow, yeah. How great! Well, and also the meeting with Bill Clinton. There's a great story.
Yeah, Clinton invited him to the White House for dinner during his first term, and Reynolds and his assistant entered via the elevator to the private quarters, and when the elevator reached the private quarters floor and the doors open, Clinton was standing there to greet him and began to recite from memory the opening sentence of A Long and Happy Life.
Wow. Kind of a great moment there for both of them, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
Clearly a big moment for Bill Clinton. And Stephen Spender, you know, you mentioned him. He was part of that meeting with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, but very important to Reynolds.
Yeah. Stephen actually gave Reynolds his first commercial publication when he published a story in Encounter magazine, which was probably the top intellectual magazine in Europe at the time. Reynolds was a student at Oxford when Stephen published the story in Encounter, and things flowed out of that subsequently.
And there was a visit then. It was actually Stephen Spender's son who came to visit Reynolds in the last week of his life.
Yes, Matthew Spender, Stephen's son, who's both the physical and intellectual heir of his father, is doing a biography of his father. And the largest single collection of Stephen Spender letters in any archive is his correspondence with Reynolds over a 50-year period at Duke. And there's a daunting number of letters in it, and Reynolds gave Matthew access. That last full week of Reynolds' life, Stephen would, when he finished his research at Duke for the day at 5, he would drive his rental car to Reynolds' house. They'd have a quick supper together and then debrief on what Matthew had found that day. It was the period of Reynolds' most intense pain, and he was on morphine as medication for his pain. But during those times he had with Matthew, he was as alive and as much himself as he had been at any time in months. Reynolds has said to me shortly before Matthew's arrival, "I look forward to being Reynolds Price again." And when Matthew was with him, he was.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today and sharing these insights and great stories. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Memzee Price and Bill Price. Bill Price is Reynolds Price's brother and Memzee his niece. And Reynolds, by the way, Reynolds Price's posthumous memoir is called Midstream. Coming up next on The State of Things, singer Gene Jolly performs live in our studio. Please stay with us.